This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, the U.S., especially the Northeast, is in the midst of a heroin epidemic. We'll hear stories about addiction, treatment, and recovery from around New England. But first, the State Department of Correction today is expected to announce its decision on whether a transgender teen will continue to be detained at York Correctional Institution, a women's prison in Niantic, or if the 16-year-old will be transferred to Manson, a facility for males who are 14 to 20 years old. It's a story that takes on special importance because of the status of this young woman, transgendered, not charged with a crime, and because of the state's controversial decision to open a locked facility for girls who fit her profile. Her advocates ask, why hasn't this girl been placed in this new facility? WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil has been covering this story and joins us with more. Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
So, first of all, how did the juvenile end up in an adult prison in the first place?
It's a very unusual story. Her attorneys tell me this is a juvenile that's been in D.C. care since she was 5 years old. She was removed from her family's home because of abuse and neglect. And the proceedings that led her to York really started up in January when her public defenders represented her in court after DCF began a process to transfer custody of the teen to the Department of Correction. DCF claimed that they had no facility for her after she was removed from a Massachusetts girls facility earlier this year. She was arrested there because she had assaulted staff. Her attorneys here say the incident resulted just in minor injuries, and the Massachusetts authorities never pursued charges. But there is a state law here in Connecticut that allows DCF to request a transfer of custody of a juvenile if they are a danger to him or herself, or they cannot be held safely at a DCF facility. And DCF admits this is a statute that's rarely used. The last time was about 13 years ago. And after 2 months in court, a judge this week agreed with DCF that this teen, the 16-year-old, should be transferred to Department of Correction custody, and she right now is at York Correctional Institution in Niantic.
And again, we'll find out more from the DOC about her status later on today. Mm-hmm. So is this the first time that a transgender juvenile has been placed in a Connecticut State prison in this way?
This has never happened before, according to the Department of Correction, in Connecticut history, where there is a transgender juvenile detained at an adult prison. Now, several organizations have been troubled by what DCF, this request by DCF, including True Colors, the ACLU, and Connecticut's Child Advocate. I spoke with Child Advocate Sarah Egan, and she told me it's very concerning that the state has sent a 16-year-old to an adult prison when she hasn't been charged or convicted of a crime. Her attorneys refute DCF's claims that she's dangerous to such a degree that custody would have to be transferred to the Department of Correction. And both the child advocate and her attorney stress this is a teen that's experienced significant trauma and needs help. This is one of her attorneys, Aaron Romano, who spoke with me yesterday.
Frankly, it's an embarrassment to the state because we know that the commissioner of DCF went before the legislature and specifically asked for monies to be provided to open up a locked house facility for juveniles and used Jane Doe as an example of why they needed these facilities. And rather than to go ahead and put Jane Doe, the very same story that she put forth before the legislature, in that facility that is now opening and is now open and functioning, she's choosing to just send Jane Doe to jail.
So that's attorney Aaron Romano. He's talking about a public hearing before the Appropriations Committee in February. Commissioner Katz spoke before that committee. They were asking for $2.6 million a year to open this new locked girls unit at the Riverview Hospital, the former Riverview Hospital.
And this is a unit that that the commissioner talked on our program about. It's been very controversial. And essentially, not only in front of this committee at the legislature, but also on our air, used examples just like this on about why this facility is needed.
That's right. And we have a clip from Commissioner Joette Katz when she spoke to Where We Live last month.
That's what's unique about these kids. They have been the victims of trauma. They have been either abused, sexually abused, whatever the circumstances are, and they need that much more of an intensive-based treatment.
Now, we reached out to DCF several times. We wanted to know, why isn't the 16-year-old at the new girls' unit in Middletown. It just opened in mid-March. They would not discuss the case. We did see the court order from Tuesday. The judge took into account another incident in November of 2013 when the teen assaulted a public safety officer at Bridgeport Detention Center. That's one of the reasons that the judge approved the request to send her to the Department of Correction. It's also important to note, while this was all going on in the courts the past 2 months, this transgender teen who's now at York, DCF had placed the 16-year-old at the Connecticut Juvenile Training School for Boys in Middletown. She was there for 2 months without incident.
And, of course, one of the worries is that this transgender teen, whether she's placed in a facility for boys, a facility for young men, or an adult prison for men or women, this is someone who could be put in a very compromising, very difficult position, someone who, as we've said, has been through quite a lot in her life. Mm-hmm. Later today, the DOC announces its decision. What happens next?
Well, it's going to be in the courts for a while. So Aaron Romano, who we heard from, they're supposed to announce today. They had 72 hours to assess the teen, where she will be either at York or if they're going to send her to Manson. Now, Attorney Romano is set to file an injunction or temporary restraining order if the DOC decides to send her to Manson, or if they decide we're going to keep the 16-year-old at York, but we're going to isolate her from the general population. Her attorneys say this is a violation of her constitutional rights as a juvenile who should be in a rehabilitative and not a correctional setting.
So this isolation could potentially be a legal problem as well. Isolating from the general population to protect her might mm-hmm. violate her civil rights.
That's right. Again, she has not been convicted of a crime, and you're going to put her in an adult women's prison, and she's not getting any rehabilitation, which is what Commissioner Katz has said. That's why this locked girls unit needed to be open, to give girls with significant trauma involved in the juvenile justice system a chance at a better life, a chance at recovery.
This is WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil. Stand by, Lucy, because we're going to be talking to you more about our other story today. If you want to read more on her reporting on this issue, it goes to WNPR.org. You can also listen back to the program recently where the commissioner of the DCF was on our show. Now, back in February, we aired a program on heroin and the science of addiction. That program came in response to the death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose untimely death, the result of a heroin overdose, drew national attention to use and addiction of the drug, as did the State of the State speech by Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin, who devoted his entire address to the problem there. Now, here's St. Francis Hospital's Dr. Sarita Rao talking to us on Where We Live.
I think if you think about the trade routes of heroin, a lot of it comes, you know, from, let's say, a place like Afghanistan, and then it just gets moved along the land routes through Europe or, you know, Africa, and it hits the Northeast. So some of it is just availability, and some of it is that it is a highly addictive drug. And the third thing, which the governor of Vermont, you know, really touched upon, I loved what he said, was sad but true, is that we have an absolute epidemic of prescription opiate use in the United States. Some statistics show that we use 80% of the world's narcotic prescriptions here in the U.S., and the second country to use it is Canada.
The effects that heroin and other opioids have had in our region is something that local reporters Lucy Nalpathanchil, Kristen Gourlay, and Karen Brown have been keeping a close eye on in recent months. All three of them will join us today to share what they've found about heroin use and addiction in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. You can join us as well, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. Joining us is Kristen Gourlay, who's a healthcare reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. Her documentary, Killer Drugs, Tackling Opioid Addiction and Overdose, will be airing on WNPR's Essential Radio this Sunday night starting at 7 o'clock. Kristen, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So from your perspective, how did this heroin epidemic in Rhode Island specifically come to be? How did this start?
Well, heroin has been a problem on and off. It's been available for a very, very long time, decades, in fact, and its use spiked. You know, we saw in the 60s and 70s, and then it kind of died down, and other drugs became a bit more prominent. What's happened more recently is that prescription painkillers, opioids, have become increasingly popular. These are drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, which are excellent at controlling pain in the short term, I'm told by doctors and researchers, especially for people with chronic end-of-life terminal illnesses. Excuse me, not chronic, but end-of-life and terminal illnesses, people experiencing a great deal of pain at the end of life. They're not as great, we're finding out, for chronic long-term pain like back pain, which is another issue. But what's happened is these drugs have just flooded the market. We've prescribed them and prescribed them and prescribed them. You can get a prescription incredibly easily for a lot of days. And the thing is, these drugs are incredibly addictive, much more addictive than anybody realized, and perhaps more than people who are taking them or even doctors realize. And it's easy to get hooked. You can get hooked quite easily after you've been taking them for not very long. And these drugs are basically the same high, the same ingredients as heroin. So when your habit becomes too expensive, if you've started abusing or become addicted to these prescription drugs and have exhausted your ability to get prescriptions, you've started buying them on the street, you'll find that they're very, very expensive. Sometimes your habit, I've heard from some addicts, can run $200, $300, $400, $500 a week. You'll find that heroin is a cheaper alternative.
It's a cheaper alternative. It's something that we've been hearing. What's the accessibility like? Is there just more heroin on the streets now than there has been in the past?
I think, yes, that there are markets for heroin today where there have never been markets for heroin before. And we've seen that in terms of the demographics of people who are using heroin, who are dying of heroin and other opioid overdoses. It's increasingly suburban and rural. It's increasingly white, middle class. It's still predominantly men, at least in Rhode Island, but growing numbers of women are experiencing this as well. Rhode Island and Connecticut are also happen to be at the nexus of certain heroin trade routes. And I heard your doctor say earlier that, you know, heroin is coming from Afghanistan. It's coming quite a bit more from South America as well, and traveling through either New York or coming secondarily into the ports outside of Providence. And I've talked to many, many addicts and people in recovery who tell me it's just so easy to find. And the problem is, when you're buying something on the street, well, there are many problems, but it could be laced with things you don't even know that are even deadlier than
heroin. We don't know about the strength. We don't know about what it's cut with. Lucy, do you want to jump in?
When we've talked with law enforcement here in Connecticut, and we talk about how readily available heroin is, and it's so cheap. In Connecticut, $5 to $12 a bag, much more, less expensive than what you see with getting Percocet and OxyContin on the streets.
I want to play a clip from the documentary on Rhode Island Public Radio from Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's chief medical officer for a network of treatment facilities, co-founder of Physicians for Responsible Opiate Prescribing, someone whose voice we hear a lot in this documentary.
The reason we're seeing heroin on the rise is that we have, again, an epidemic of people who are addicted to opioids, and you've got drug dealers who have found new markets for heroin in places where heroin never before existed.
Kristen Gourlay spoke with a number of doctors like Dr. Kolodny and other health experts about their views on opiate prescriptions. Here's epidemiologist Tracy Green's take on the way pain pills are prescribed in Rhode Island.
As a state, taking community responsibility means that everybody has to really think about how are we contributing to, perhaps whether we mean to or not, to the deaths that we're seeing.
Green says we have to ask ourselves, do we really need so many pain pills? Are they worth the risk?
Whether we are, as a society, wanting more medications and not knowing when to say no more, and when we're willing to maybe accept some degree of pain, or thinking about other ways to live and cope with pain.
Kristen, this is really important. You brought this up before. This isn't just a street drug problem that starts with addicts who crave drugs and someone selling something illicit on the street. You're suggesting, and a lot of healthcare experts are telling reporters like you and Lucy and Karen Brown, that it starts in the doctor's office. People are just prescribing too many opioids.
This is your mother. This is your brother. It's your sister. It's your son. It's your neighbor. This isn't a problem that's affecting some, ridiculous stereotype of a, quote, junkie in an alley, unquote. That's not what's happening. What's happening is, you have lower back pain or you have surgery. Your doctor prescribes you 30, 60, 90 days of a very, very potent, very addictive painkiller. You start taking them, you get hooked, and you start, you know, some people will become dependent and go on to become addicted, and then you're off and running.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about new ways to deal with overdoses. We're going to be talking more with reporters who are covering the story throughout the Northeast. Kristen Gourlay is here from Rhode Island Public Radio. Her documentary about heroin use and addiction in Rhode Island is going to be played on WNPR's Essential Radio coming up this Sunday at 7 o'clock. Also joining us is Lucy Nalpathanchil, who's been covering this issue for WNPR. And we're joined by Karen Brown, who reports for the New England Public Radio and also the Boston Globe. You can join us at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're following up on a recent story about heroin in the Northeast. We took a look at the science of addiction recently, but now we're looking at how it's affecting our communities here in New England. It's an especially bad problem in New England states, and we have reporters from Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Also take your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. One of the reporters is Kristen Gourlay, who's a healthcare reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. She has a documentary about addiction and heroin use that we're going to be airing Sunday at 7 on WNPR's Essential Radio. One of the things that you've talked about is how law enforcement deals with overdose cases. Overdose is a huge problem. What can and can't officers do at the scene of an overdose?
Well, increasingly, officers can administer an antidote called Narcan or naloxone, and there are a number of ways to administer it. There's a nasal spray. You just squirt it up each nostril, and that you can administer it intravenously, intramuscularly. That's increasingly becoming an option for law enforcement, but it wasn't always the case, and it's still. And there are law enforcement officers throughout the country that still don't carry it. EMTs, ambulance paramedics, they've been carrying Narcan for a long time now. But we've started realizing that because in certain places, police are often first on the scene, especially if you live in a rural area where you have, you know, a volunteer ambulance service or something. You know, police could definitely be the first on the scene if someone calls 911. And so people are increasingly feeling that they also need to be equipped with this antidote.
A police department in Quincy, Massachusetts, had one of the nation's first Narcan programs. Mm-hmm. Here's Quincy Police Department Lieutenant Patrick Glynn speaking to Kristen about some of the opposition toward allowing police to administer Narcan.
There are some detractors that don't think police officers should be administering medication. But what I would say to those people are, take a look left and right when you're walking down the street. Any one of those people that are not in uniform carrying a badge and a weapon may have nasal naloxone on them. You're calling 911 for assistance. That person showing up with the authority instilled by them from Rhode Island is not carrying nasal naloxone. So they're at a deficit to help you.
Right. And what he's talking about is the fact that in Massachusetts and now in Rhode Island, basically anyone can get Narcan. And in fact, there have been some emergency regulations instituted in Rhode Island that enable doctors to prescribe it to family members and friends of people who are using so that they can, you know, if they're around when someone is overdosing, they can administer this. There's also a standing prescription at Walgreens pharmacies in Rhode Island where anyone can go and get and pick up some doses of Narcan.
Lucy Nalpathanchil from WNPR has been covering this issue for us here. Lucy?
I just wanted to say that here in Connecticut 2 years ago, a law was passed that would also allow anyone to get a prescription for Narcan. There hasn't been a lot of awareness and outreach built around that law, so now we have a law or a bill that's in before the legislature that would actually grant immunity to anyone who administers an opioid antagonist, Narcan, to another person who's experiencing a drug overdose. I also wanted to point out that here in Connecticut, paramedics and hospital staff are the ones that administer Narcan. There has been, police here in Connecticut and EMTs are not on board yet with administering Narcan. Mm-hmm. So we have an overdose prevention working group here in the state that's working on trying to engage EMTs and police about the importance of Narcan. We even heard from the U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, encouraging all law enforcement to carry Narcan because of the heroin epidemic.
There is a law on the books in Rhode Island, it's a Good Samaritan law, and several other states have these that give some kind of immunity to someone who calls 911 and or administers Narcan. So that's spreading. And I should just say also that Narcan is kind of an amazing drug, and I don't have stock in it or anything like that, but it works in seconds. And seconds are sometimes what you have when someone's overdosing.
Well, to find out more about this, let's go to Dr. Eric Collins, who's Physician-in-Chief at Silver Hill Hospital in New Canaan. Dr. Collins, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Our reporters have been singing the praises of naloxone, of Narcan. Explain exactly how it works and why it works so fast.
So naloxone binds the opioid receptor but doesn't activate it. And it has a higher affinity, essentially a higher attraction for the opioid receptor than virtually all opioids. So when it gets into the bloodstream and crosses into the nervous system, it will displace the opioid that's binding the receptor, and essentially the overdose death is caused by the respiratory center being turned off. Our automatic drive to breathe, even when we're asleep, can be turned off by opioids. So when naloxone attaches there, displaces the opioid, but doesn't activate the receptor, it suddenly takes away, it's really turning on the switch to breathe. That's essentially why it works so fast. It gets into the system quickly, displaces the opioid, and turns on the switch to breathe.
Aside from this movement by law enforcement in some places, and certainly by individuals in states like Connecticut and Rhode Island to administer this drug, news this month also of an FDA approval of naloxone. Explain exactly what the FDA approval means.
Well, okay, so naloxone has been approved by the FDA for over 40 years. The news last week was a fast-track approval of a particular device, and I have no stock in this company, but I do think it's a nice device. It's called Evzio, is the product, and it's a single injection of naloxone with audio and written instructions. So when it's turned on, audio instructions will be played for administration of naloxone, and there's some training that we like to give people. But it's a new product, and it's important. Though what's done in Rhode Island, and that's really been a nice move, and I think it'll be a model for what happens across the country in the next year, I hope. Naloxone's already been available. Evzio is a nice product, and the audio play is analogous to what we see with automatic defibrillator devices when someone's had a heart attack, when their heart has stopped. In an emergency, people are scared, and having an audio playback telling you what to do can be very helpful.
Let's go to the phones. John is calling from Hamden. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm a retired firefighter from the city of New Haven, and earlier in the conversation it was stated that EMTs and police in the state of Connecticut basically don't use Narcan to bring anyone back who's who went out because of heroin use. And is that incorrect? Like I said, late 80s into the 90s, I was an EMT. Even though I could not administer Narcan, all of our paramedics could. I've been on scene with a bunch of people at that time who had overdosed from heroin, who we brought back. It is an amazing drug. Wake right up. But prior to me getting on the New Haven Fire Department, they were using Narcan.
John, thank you very much for that. Lucy, did you want to jump in quickly?
I thought I did say that paramedics have been administering Narcan. I've been told that EMTs do not administer Narcan. It's paramedics and an ambulance company. And I've heard that I've also spoken to law enforcement around the state that there is some apprehension about, they don't see that as their role administering Narcan. Again, that's why that AIDS Connecticut has an overdose prevention working group to work with EMTs to try to see if there can be more first responders that administer Narcan to people that are going through an overdose.
Kristen?
I think in Rhode Island, maybe elsewhere, the distinction is that you need a certain certification to administer it intravenously, but anyone can pretty much administer it through nasal Narcan.
The importance of this new device you spoke of, Dr. Collins, is it seems that if you can administer it quickly and you can administer it even if you are a layperson, someone who doesn't have any medical training, this will, I think in your mind and the minds of a lot of others who follow this, it will help to save lives.
It will. There have been studies, a collection of many organizations have reported over 10,000 opioid overdose reversals in the last 10 years. And so it's certainly, I'm convinced it'll save lives. We really just need to be able to make this or other forms of naloxone, the nasal spray we spoke of earlier, or just a simple injection kit. We need to make them widely available.
Dr. Eric Collins is Physician-in-Chief at Silver Hill Hospital in New Canaan. Thank you, sir, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure. May I say one more thing?
Of course, please do.
So we're talking about overdose prevention, and I just wanted to bring everyone's attention to what has become an annual event, the National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. That's on April 26th, and it's supported by the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. One of the main problems is opioids get out there and they're prescribed to people, and often it's not the people themselves who get addicted, but children, adolescents who go looking in medicine cabinets, and they try things and they become hooked that way. There are so many prescriptions out there that remain unused, and these are valuable and useful tools. People don't want to throw them away. I would encourage everyone to participate in the Prescription Drug Take-Back Day on April 26th, and look, the DEA website has information on where you can find some local sources to deliver your drugs and get rid of them.
And we'll put some more information on our website, WNPR.org, for that. Dr. Collins, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking about the epidemic of heroin use here in New England. We're speaking with Lucy Nalpathanchil, who's been covering this issue for WNPR, Kristen Gourlay, who is a healthcare reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. We want to bring in Karen Brown, who's a health reporter for New England Public Radio, who also writes on healthcare for the Boston Globe. She joins us from the studios of New England Public Radio today in Massachusetts. Karen, welcome back to our show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's turn to a story of a young man, Lance Rice, who's been fighting hard to overcome his heroin addiction. It's a story that you've reported for New England Public Radio and for the Boston Globe. Tell us a bit of Lance's story.
Well, he's been he's a pretty classic example of an adolescent. He started as an adolescent getting hooked on opiate pills, and he eventually moved into heroin. And he was pretty much addicted from the age of 15 to about 23. Last year, when he was 23, he was arrested for a whole string of robberies in Turner's Falls, which is in the primarily rural Franklin County, which is another part of this story, just how this drug has really infiltrated rural areas that really hadn't seen it for a long time. But Lance had basically been he'd been chased by law enforcement and by angry community members for almost a year before he finally got arrested and put in jail. But what was interesting to me about his story is that one of the people that he robbed, one of the houses that he robbed, belonged to a woman named Nina Rossi, who herself is a recovering alcoholic. She's in her 50s now. And there was something about his story that really touched her, and she decided that after she kind of got over the hurt and the violation of being robbed, she actually reached out to him, offered to be a resource for him. And they've become, through his very rocky trip to rehab and recovery, and he's had a pretty tough time of it, but he's actually been able to use the resources and the friendship of this woman that he robbed to help him. Currently, he says he is clean. So
what does their story tell us about some of the support and the services that are available to those who are trying to overcome addiction and overcome some of the problems that Lance has found himself in over his life?
Well, you know, he talked to me a lot about how hard it is to get help when you need it, and how even just you know, he had before he had the good luck of robbing the house of someone who really took him under her wing. He had tried to quit several times, and he says what happens is, you know, you go to detox, for instance, and you get out, and there's nowhere to go for rehab. And even a day or two, you're back on the street, and you see the people that you used to shoot up with, and you just, you know, the cravings become unbearable. And there's other additional problems of logistics. So now that he's back in town, he's on very strict probation conditions. He's got to go to AA meetings every day. He's got to go to random drug screenings at a courthouse whenever they call him. And if he can't get there by a certain time, you know, by noon, I think, he gets put back into jail, and he doesn't have a car. So again, he's what this story has told me is how important it is to have a really strong support system around you. And again, this is sort of a very unusual story because of this particular relationship, but he's been able to find someone who has really done a lot for him, and most people do not have that, and he didn't used to have that. And that's kind of what it told me.
As you've reported, Lance has been close to relapsing. Hear from your story. He and Nina Rossi talk about some of the struggles that come with recovery and the constant threat of relapse.
Well, I think about, my God, what would happen if he started using again? That would be devastating. I'd have to practice some real detachment to get through that.
You know, it wouldn't be Nina's fault at all if I went out and did something, you know? And it would suck that I would probably lose her over something like that. That also probably does help me, you know, stay clean.
Mm. Karen, it's a powerful story in large part because you get at the stories of the people who care for those who are struggling with addiction, care for them deeply. Sometimes they're family members, sometimes they're friends, but they suffer through this just as well, and there's not very many support services available for them.
Yeah, and you know, he told me that his own family, you know, his I believe some members of his family have also been struggling with the same issues, and I think that's probably fairly common, and they are not in a real position to help him at that point. And moreover, he probably sees a lot of problems around him all the time, and there's probably a fair amount of temptation there. What was instructive to me was exactly what kind of help he gets. For instance, his friend Nina, she pays for taxis for him to go to the courthouse when she's not available to drive him. She gets him paid jobs because he doesn't have money to pay for the bus. I mean, these are very small things, but it makes you understand how these small things, if you don't have them, can lead you right back into addiction.
Kristen Gourlay, in your reporting in Rhode Island, how much support is out there for people who are struggling with addiction in Rhode Island? How much support do they need from families and friends? I mean, obviously, as Karen said, Lance's story is a bit unusual because he has in some ways a guardian angel looking out for him. Many others don't. What can you tell us about support services in Rhode Island?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a range of support services depending on what an individual addict needs. They go from, you know, the most support, which is inpatient, residential, long-term treatment for addiction, which, you know, some people will need. And you need that in order to not only get your head clear, you know, get stabilized and start thinking about your future, be removed from the people, places, and things that used to trigger you to use, but also for your body to just detoxify and stabilize. Detoxing from opioids is one of the most painful things you can go through. I'm told it's like the worst flu you can imagine times a million, you know, and so people will do anything to avoid that feeling. So having some help through that is what helps people at least establish some sobriety and stick with it. And then you can go to, you know, outpatient or partial day hospitalization. Then you can go to support group meetings like Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And then for the families, there are different kinds of programs through nonprofits, but also there's Al-Anon, which is a 12-step support group for family and friends of alcoholics. And I believe there's also Narcanon. Maybe somebody can help me with that one. It's the analog for in the narcotics world. And they're all different issues. They're all different other kinds of supports for family members as well. The thing is, though, that it's not clear how the Affordable Care Act in particular will affect access to and length of stay for things like inpatient addiction treatment. That could be in flux. It's expensive.
Oh, I mean, that's a very interesting point. And when we come back from our break, we're actually going to talk to Lucy Nalpathanchil about a family in Guilford that she's been covering and how they're coping with this. We're going to take some of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. We're talking on the program today about heroin abuse and addiction, and also what we're doing to help those in need. We're talking with Kristen Gourlay, who you just heard from Rhode Island Public Radio. Also joining us is Karen Brown from New England Public Radio. Can you stick around for a bit, Karen?
I sure can.
And Lucy Nalpathanchel is here from WNPR. We'll take your calls when we come back. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up Monday, in her new book, Hello World, Where Design Meets Life, author Alex Rothzorn delves deep into the multifaceted world of design. We'll talk about good design that helps us and bad design that can hinder our daily routines. We want to know from you, what role does design play in your life? It's not just talking about your iPhone either. We're going to talk about design on the next Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about a heroin epidemic in the United States, especially in the Northeast. We're talking with reporters Karen Brown from New England Public Radio, Kristen Gourlay from Rhode Island Public Radio, and Lucy Nalpathanchel from here at WNPR. Let's get to a few quick phone calls on this issue. John's on a cell phone. Hi, John.
Hi, John. I've called before. I have two quick points. One, I wanted to talk about pain, taking narcotics, pain as a choice. I've got very bad chronic back pain, almost debilitating back pain at times, from 34 years in the military, 11 deployments, 4 combat deployments. And every time I go to the VA, they encourage me to take narcotics for pain. I choose to not take the narcotics for my back pain. Right now, I'm in my car on a long drive, and I have a heating pad on my car to help me manage my back pain. It's a choice to take these or not take these narcotics for these chronic conditions. And two, I wanted to talk about that the origins of this. This is a new problem within the last 10 or 15 years. How did this all start? And I can tell you as a healthcare professional, I'm a registered nurse, that one day some very esteemed, educated people from what's called the Joint Commission of Healthcare Accreditation woke up one day, and they decided that they were going to start inspecting hospitals and doctors' practices on how they manage people's pain, and they started saying things like pain was the fifth vital sign and all kinds of crap like that. And that's what drove this sort of this requirement for doctors and hospitals to manage people's pain by simply throwing pills at them.
John, thank you very much for that. And Kristen, you wanted to jump in and...
Oh, it's an excellent point. You know, hospitals and other doctors' offices have, you know, their accreditation was at a certain point, it was hanging on how well they managed patients' pain. And one of the most effective ways doctors knew, of course, was to prescribe these narcotics. So that set us on the road to this, you know, prescribing mountains and mountains and mountains of these pills. He's absolutely right.
And I know something that we've looked at, Lucy, too. He mentions the VA. This is a problem, certainly. Veterans Administration hospitals giving out pain pills, including to people they know have had problems with opioid addiction in the past.
Opioid addiction and then having underlying mental health conditions like depression and anxiety. Mm. So how are they coping? They're coping by, you know, taking more and more of these narcotics that, you know, results in overdoses. And the VA has been looked at for, you know, over-prescribing these to veterans who really should not be taking this medication.
You can find out more about that if you go to WNPR.org and you look at Lucy Nalpathanchel's Coming Home Project. We've been doing reporting on that as well. Karen Brown, Kristen brought up something last segment that I wanted to just get back to on this. She mentioned the Affordable Care Act. I'm wondering if you know anything about how Obamacare affects any of this, the ability for people to get treatment, the ability for people to get help. How is the ACA affecting any of this, if you know?
You know, I really haven't been following that very well. I do know that from the addicts that I've talked to, they feel so sort of separated from the healthcare system. You know, they're not even sure where to go and how it's going to affect them. But I really don't know the details of that.
What I can tell you from my reporting in Rhode Island is just that, you know, there are a limit. When we're just talking about inpatient residential treatment here, and I just want to say that not every addict needs
That's
that
right.
level of treatment. But for people who do, there are limited number of those treatment beds available, including I should include detox and inpatient treatment beds. And in Rhode Island, a certain number of those were paid for basically by the state. Now they're going to be paid for through Medicaid, assuming that everyone will have some form of insurance at this point. And the thing is, it's just not clear how much treatment Medicaid will be willing to pay for as a result of the Affordable Care Act.
I want to turn to another story, an important story about adolescent substance abuse, a three-part series that Lucy Nalpathanchil reported for WNPR. You focused on a family from Guilford, the Harmon family. They almost lost their son, Tim, to an overdose. Tell us a bit about their story.
Well, I found them when we looked at the idea of addiction, and when I got this startling statistic that 9 out of 10 adults who abuse drugs and alcohol, they started using these substances when they were adolescents. So we looked at addiction among adolescents, and Kristen mentioned there are very few inpatient residential beds for people who need them, especially here in Connecticut. There's very few inpatient residential for adolescents. And so Rushford, part of Hartford Healthcare, has is one of the only residential treatment centers for boys that serve adolescent boys, and that's how I met the Harmons. Their son was struggled with multiple addiction to multiple substances, including synthetic marijuana and prescription opiate drugs. They didn't know how bad his addiction was until the mother, Mary Harmon, encountered her son ODing, and she tells us about the moment when she went to the hospital.
Timmy had coded again. He had died again. And she said to me, "Do you want to be with him?" And I said, "Yes." And I sent the other children away with our chaplain. And she walked back into the room and she brought me to him. And he had been intubated and they were pushing drugs to try to get a pulse back and a blood pressure. And I held his hand and I said, "Tim, it's not time to go. It's not time to go. It's Mom. Please come back. Please come back. We need you here with us."
That's Mary Harmon. That's a moment that no parent wants to go through. Luckily, her son fully recovered. And then he spent a year and a half, two stays at Rushford, a program at Rushford here in Durham, and then another program, a Turning Point for Young Men in New Haven. And now he is in recovery. But again, they struggled with finding inpatient residential treatment for their son. And then they struggled with getting their commercial insurance to pay for the traditional 28-day program.
So really problems with insurance. When we were talking about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, it was just the traditional insurers, it presents a lot of problems and roadblocks for families.
That's right. Now, if you have a teenage girl who is dealing with substance abuse and you want her in an inpatient residential, the only option here in Connecticut is to send her to out-of-state Arms Acres in Carmel, New York. It's on the New York-Connecticut border. I spoke with the director of adolescent programs there, Earl Wiggins. They've helped over 100 Connecticut adolescents in the last year.
With Medicaid, we get a chance to work with them a little bit longer, but commercial insurances, they look at medical necessity. So they may give us 5 days to start, and then we have to justify keeping them for another 5 days, and more often than not, we have to deal with the 10 or the 15 days that they might give us, the commercial insurances. Then we do what we call the microwave version.
And the microwave version is that shorter stay where they give them a plan, they try to get them connected to outpatient treatment. But what's complicated with adolescents with substance abuse is their brains. They aren't fully developed. So we've heard from doctors before on this show, you know, the last parts of the brain to develop in an adolescent, early 20s, we're talking about making decisions, weighing pros and cons, thinking out consequences. But the pleasure-seeking part of the brain, that's fully developed. So when a teen especially gets addicted to something like opiates, it's very hard. The brain is almost hijacked. And we heard from Rushford's medical director, Dr. J. Craig Allen. He calls this the perfect storm when a teenager gets addicted to substances.
If they're going back to the same environment, if there's been no chance to work with the family, if there's been no chance to establish outpatient resources and a sober environment, a sober support group, chances are 100% this kid's going to go back to the same high school, have the same people hanging around him, have the same numbers on his phone, and going to be using it again.
And that's the same story that we heard from Karen Brown in Massachusetts earlier during our program. I want to get to a few quick phone calls before we run low on time. Aaron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate this show. My family lost my brother 5 years ago due to this epidemic that's going on, and this show is really getting the word out there. We need to do this more. We need to be there for these young kids that are going through these temptations, these demons that are haunting them every day, and be there for them so that they can get better. It starts with the healthcare system, and then it just cycles from there. And we just need to to get the word out there. People need to be proactive.
Erin, thank you very much for your phone call. I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'm glad you shared your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Karen Brown, before I let you go, I know that you've been trying to get the word out about this stuff in Massachusetts and to a national audience with your reporting for NPR for a number of years. Do you think that, you know, all this conversation, all this reporting is starting to help people see what's going on in communities around New England?
Well, I know my children are starting to pay attention to it. They're teenagers, and my daughter was walking around recently and saw a discarded prescription pill bottle, and she mentioned something about, I wonder if that's part of the drug deal, and I wonder if that's from a heroin addict. And I have to think that the more, you know, we talk about this, the more adolescents maybe will be aware that this is a danger. Maybe they're able to sort of identify behavior in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. I also wanted to bring out one other thing, which is I think it's important to think about how the justice system is working in terms of helping heroin addicts. Again, Lance Rice, the man that I interviewed, said the only reason he stopped doing heroin was because he was sent to jail and he was part of a drug court, which put in place a lot of these very strict recovery-related probation conditions. So that may be a discussion for another time, but that's a big part of this whole epidemic.
And it's a step away in this alternative sentencing world from the old days of sort of locking people up and throwing away the key if they have certain drug-related crimes on their resume. Karen Brown is a health reporter for New England Public Radio. She also writes on health for the Boston Globe. You can hear her reporting as well coming up, I believe, this weekend on Sunday's weekend, All Things Considered. Karen, always good to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to get to one quick phone call. I think we have time for Marissa in New Milford. Hi, Marissa. Go ahead.
Hi. As many of you probably have heard, in New Milford, there have been 4 overdose deaths in the past year. My daughter is a recovering addict and fortunately clean and sober for 11 months. But I wanted to share a wonderful support group, Parent Connection in Newtown, Connecticut, that meets on Thursday nights from 7 to 9 in the town hall. You learn in that support group that the parents, you have to take care of yourself and not to blame yourself. And it really has been helpful to many of us who go to that meeting. So I just wanted to share that there is support out there for parents as well, of people in recovery.
Marissa, thank you very much for that, and I appreciate your story. And Lucy, she mentions a local community that's gone through this problem. You've reported on a few local communities here, one that's out near me, where I live, out in Torrington, another New Britain. These are places where this epidemic that we talk about, that's across the United States, that's across the Northeast, really plays at a very, very local level. And they're harrowing stories in towns like Torrington.
And it affects everyone, not just a certain socioeconomic class. And in Torrington, you know, they saw at least 10 fatalities just in 2013 related to heroin overdoses. So they have a local community task force, the hospital there, Charlotte Hungerford, working to get a case manager out into the community more to try to connect people who are suffering from addiction to get into recovery, not just end up in the ER with an overdose or go to detox, then come out and then use again to try to, you know, continue these people on a path to recovery. It is a day-by-day process. That's what the Harmons and Guilford are dealing with their son. They take it a day at a time. They wanted to share the story because of stigma. It affects everyone.
Well, and stigma that sometimes keeps people from getting the help that they need, stigma that can overcome a community. I know I covered years ago Willimantic when it was spread across the front page of the Hartford Courant as heroin town. Years later, they're still dealing with that stigma, and it's difficult. I know Kristen Gourlay, in parts of Rhode Island, this is a problem as well. Towns see an awful lot of this. I guess I'm wondering, as we just run low on time, and we have about 30 seconds left, do you have any last thoughts about how this is being tackled in your state, in Rhode Island?
Well, I think there's increasing awareness about the problem and some good ideas for how to tackle it, not only amongst community members, residents, but also policymakers, researchers, healthcare practitioners, law enforcement. So the word is getting out there. But I think one thing we need to remember is that overdose death is preventable. It's preventable. And it just takes some education and preparation.
And hopefully, if you are on the line, you wanted to join our conversation, you can continue this conversation. We just had too many people who wanted to join us to get everyone on the air. Go to WNPR.org. Kristen Gourlay's documentary, Killer Drugs, Tackling Opioid Addiction and Overdose, will air on Essential Radio this Sunday night at 7 o'clock on WNPR. Thank you so much, Kristen. Thanks also to WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil for being here. Our show is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. This is Where We Live.